our attention to the book of Philippians. Before we turn there, I want you to look at something on the screen. I want you to look at this picture. As you look at it, I want you to think about what you see. Okay? Is everybody looking at the picture? Have you got in your mind what you see? Are you confident of what you see? Okay? Now let's look at the same picture. Are you positive that what you saw the first time is what you saw the second time? Just to help you a little bit, let's go back to the first picture. Same picture. Okay, now what did anybody see a horse the first time? Now did anybody see a frog the second time? Or a horse standing on his nose, whichever your perspective is. Same picture. But the difference is which direction you look at it from. And I believe that is a microcosm, if you will, of life. That often what we see in life really does depend on how we look at it. And that the perspective with which we approach life impacts what we get out of life, what we gain from life, what we see in life. You can think of folks that you encounter on a daily basis who seem to kind of have joy and a positive attitude all the time, in spite of the fact maybe terrible things happen to them along the road of life. You can think of other folks that you know, and it seems like they're never happy. I mean, you could give them everything they ever wanted and they'd find some reason to be unhappy. You see, happiness is really not about what happens to us. It's how we handle what happens to us. And I believe there's no better example of that in the Bible, maybe, than the book of Philippians. Now, as we look at the book of Philippians, we call it Discussions from a Dungeon. As we look at this book, I want us to think about three key things. I want us to think about the city, I want us to think about the church, and then I want us to think about the cause of this letter. The city, a little bit of its background, the church, a little bit of its background, and then what caused Paul to write this letter. There was a Christian who lived in the third century who was dying. And this Christian wrote a letter to a friend, and there on the screen you can see that letter. He says, "It's a bad world, an incredibly bad world. But I have discovered in the midst of it a quiet and holy people who have learned a great secret. They have found a joy which is 1,000 times better than any pleasure in our sinful life. They are despised and persecuted, but they care not. They are masters of their souls. They have overcome the world. These people are Christians, and I am one of them." I believe that men like this man who lived in the third century could have such an attitude towards life in part because they had read the words of men like Paul, a man who wrote Philippians some 200 years before the man that we just quoted from lived. So let's hit tonight some of the highlights of this letter written to the church at Philippi. First of all, let's talk about the city. What I try to do is you look at the map on the screen. You can see the little X up there. X marks the spot. That little white X kind of up at top screen is just above the location of the city of Philippi in the region of Macedonia as we look at the Roman Empire, at least that portion of the empire closest to Rome itself. The city of Philippi was a very, very important city in the first century. In fact, if you were looking in Acts chapter 16, specifically in verse 12, it says in describing Paul's visit to Philippi, it says it was a leading city of the district of Macedonia and a Roman colony. This city was called Crinides in about 360 and was established by that name. But what happened is they eventually discovered gold there. And you can think about what happened in our country when they discovered gold. You have this massive movement to wherever the gold strike was. Same thing happened in the ancient world at Philippi. But not only do you have a lot of people going there to try to get gold, all the powers that be want the gold. And so basically what happened is Philip of Macedon, this is the father of Alexander the Great, he came in and captured the city
so that he could have the gold, and he renamed the city Philippi after himself. It also has a history beyond that. It would become a Roman colony in 42 B.C. And the reason, or the way it became a Roman colony, in fact, this city was called sometimes Little Rome or A Little Rome. But you may recall the death and the assassination of Julius Caesar. And two principal characters in that assassination were two men by the name of Brutus and Cassius. In the aftermath of the death of Julius Caesar, you have a battle which takes place, or a war in a series of battles. But basically you have a war between Brutus and Cassius and their followers, and Octavian, who would later become known as Caesar Augustus, Octavian and Mark Antony. The final battle which brought about the downfall of Brutus and Cassius was fought on the plains just outside the city of Philippi. And so after Brutus and Cassius were defeated at Philippi, then the victors, to honor their victory and to celebrate their victory, decided to make this city of Philippi a Roman colony, a special Roman city where everybody got Roman citizenship, they were exempted from Roman taxes, and they were allowed to have their own self-rule, and they were ruled by magistrates, and you find reference to that in Acts chapter 16. Now later on, Mark Antony and Octavian would go to war. Octavian would win that war, and he would become Caesar Augustus. Now one of the things he did after defeating Mark Antony, kind of as an olive branch to the soldiers who had fought for Mark Antony, is he gave them plots of land in the city of Philippi, and kind of retired them there, if you will, or at least a number of them. So as you think about Philippi, you've got a city here that is very important to the Roman Empire. It is a place that is kind of a memorial place for an important victory in the recent history, and at least at the time of Paul's writing this letter. You've got a city that has special privileges in Rome. You've got a city that is basically a retirement village for old soldiers. Okay, so I want you to think of the military background. I want you to think of the tremendous status the city would have because it had privileges that other cities did not have. It was also a city that was located about 10 miles from the Aegean Sea. It had the Ganges River running through the city, and so it had water access. It had a very fertile plain. It was a flat area with a fertile plain surrounded by mountains. It was located on the Ignatian Way, and it was kind of the first century version of, I don't know, I-40 or I-65. That was their interstate in the first century. And so any city that was located on this major Roman interstate immediately became a city of some consequence, a city of some significance. And so because of that, you had a lot of trade going in and out of the city, and we talked about this even just as recently as last week about the fact Paul chose places like this to preach the gospel. So as you think about the city of Philippi, well, it's got a rich background behind it, a very important, significant, and a fairly well-to-do city. All right, we've talked just a little bit about the city. Now let's talk about the church, about God's people in that particular location. If you go over to Acts chapter 16, verses 6 through 10, you're going to basically read about what is commonly called the Macedonian call. Now, what you find is, I remember in one of the movies that I have seen, I think there was a movie on TV called The Last Samurai, and there's a scene in that in which one of the main characters, basically, one character is saying, "This is my destiny," okay, as he is facing a battle and looks like impending defeat, and said, "This is my destiny." And the other character is played by Tom Cruise and says, basically, "I believe we do what we can until our destiny is revealed." In other words, we don't get consumed with this fatalism of, "I know it's going to turn out this way," but we become consumed with making plans until we know how things will turn out. As I think about that quote, that's kind of how Paul did mission work. His philosophy was, "I'm going to make plans, I'm going to be busy doing God's work, until God steps in and tells me I need to go in another direction. In other words, his philosophy was, I will make plans and go to work until God's plan is revealed to me. And so there are times in which God, through His Spirit, would step in and say to Paul, yes, Paul, I know you wanted to preach in the region of Asia, but I need you to go to Macedonia. That's an example here. So Paul was making plans to preach in the region of Asia. And it says that when he was at Troas at the end of verse 8 of Acts 16, and then in verse 9 it says, a vision appeared to Paul in the night, and a man of Macedonia was standing and appealing to him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. And when he had seen the vision, and notice what it says here, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. And so what happens is, he immediately gets this vision, jumps in a ship, jumps across a little kind of catty corner there on the edge of the Aegean Sea, goes to a little place called, or a city called Neapolis, and then travels 8 or 9 miles from there on to the city of Philippi. I want us to see that Paul's going to Philippi as a direct response to guidance and a vision from God. And in that vision, he was called by God, through that man he saw in that vision, to go to Macedonia. So he goes into Macedonia, and Philippi is a natural place to start. Remember, in Acts chapter 16, it talks about that Philippi was a leading city of the region of Macedonia. Now, when Paul gets there, this is primarily a Gentile city. Now, that makes sense to us because remember all its background. Remember, this is a city that's a special Roman colony with special Roman privileges, and that many of the people in the city are retired Roman soldiers. So it shouldn't surprise us we don't run into a lot of Jewish people living here. Now, there were some here, but we know that there weren't at least 10 Jewish men there, because what Paul would do when he went to a city, he would start off by going to a Jewish synagogue. Because he knew if he went to a synagogue, if he got a chance to speak there, he would be talking to people that already believed in God. So one hurdle was already overcome. All he had to do was help those people to see that Jesus was the Messiah. Whereas when he went into a Gentile audience, he had first to convince them that there was only one true God. Then he had to move from there to the Messiah. So he would always start in cities with the Jewish population. Well, he doesn't go to the synagogue in Philippi. And the fact he doesn't do that seems to relate to the fact there wasn't a synagogue. Now, according to Jewish law, if there were 10 Jewish males in a city, the local Jews were required to build a synagogue. So the fact he doesn't go to a synagogue and there's not one there tells us you've got a very small Jewish population. It happens that he comes upon some Jewish women who have gathered by the side of the river and they are praying. He meets a woman named Lydia and she becomes the first convert of this particular city. Later he comes upon a slave girl who's possessed with a demon and is given the power to foresee things, and her owners are making a lot of money off of her. Well, they cast that demon out of her. It upsets the slave owners because now they can't make money off of her demon possession. And so it ends up that they get thrown in prison, or Paul and Silas get thrown in prison. You know, maybe the story of how God, through an earthquake, opens the doors of the prison, sets them free. The jailer sees that the doors are open, thinking everyone is gone and that his life is ended, because if a prisoner escaped, the jailer and the guards got the sentence of anybody that left. So if you've got a murderer that's set free, then the jailer and the guards get whatever his sentence was. If it was death, they get death. And so he just assumed his life was over. He's preparing to take his life. He is stopped by Paul and Silas, and they end up going to his home, teaching him the gospel, and based on his faith, he is baptized into Jesus Christ. And so you have here in Acts chapter 16 the beginnings and the establishment of the Lord's church at Philippi. Paul was probably there somewhere in the early 50s, around 50, 51, 52 when he went into the city. And Paul would keep a very close relationship with Philippi. And one thing, I don't know if you've noticed when you read about Paul, Paul liked to support his ministry by his own means. Now we know when Paul first started going out on missionary journeys, he was sent out by the church at Athens. But a church that helped him financially, that financially supported his work, was the church at Philippi. Now Paul didn't let many people do that. Paul didn't want to be controlled by congregations, it seems, who were financially supporting his work. So he worked at tent making as he went from place to place, and really only took donations when he absolutely had to, and only from certain congregations. And if you read Philippians chapter 4, and we're not going to go back and read it now, but you might do it in some of your devotional reading at home. If you read Philippians chapter 4, Philippi had in the past, and at the time of the writing of this letter, played an important role in financially supporting his work. And so he has a very close and special relationship with this group of Christians. Paul would later go back and visit Philippi again after they get out of prison. In the events of Acts chapter 16, he leaves the city at the request of the local magistrates, of the local leaders, but later, according to Acts 20 and 1 Corinthians 2, he would come back to visit. But that's another lesson. Let's talk more specifically about the cause of this letter. Why did Paul write this letter to this city and to this congregation of Christians? Hey, first of all, we've got to look at Paul's condition. I want to look at Paul's condition, and then we'll look at Philippi's conduct. And then we'll talk a little bit more about the purpose of this correspondence between Paul and this congregation. First of all, Paul's condition. It seems that Paul is in prison as of the writing of this letter. In chapter 1, he makes reference to the Praetorian Guard. In chapter 4, he makes reference to Caesar's household. Some have put this imprisonment at Ephesus, at Caesarea. But most believe that this imprisonment, it's obvious from reading Philippians that he is in prison. And that he is probably in prison in Rome in what we commonly call the first Roman imprisonment. And so you're in the early 60s. It's about 10 years removed from when he first went to this congregation, and those events are recorded in Acts chapter 16. And so he is in prison. And he's writing this letter back to Philippi. Now, if you go to Acts chapter 28, you may remember that there it talks about Paul's imprisonment in Rome. And in that chapter, Paul is in his own rented apartment in Rome. In other words, he doesn't have freedom. He can't travel about. But he's not in a dungeon. He's not in a prison cell. He is in his own rented apartment, and folks can come and visit him there and so forth. He has a little more freedom, at least in visitation. But it seems from the tone of the Philippian letter that things have changed. He is now probably under military guard. He has already been before the tribunal at least once. He is under harsher conditions. He's moved from his own rented apartments to what was likely was a dungeon, a prison cell. And as he is in that prison cell, he is contemplating his future. And you really see that brought out in chapter 1. He realizes that apparently they're about to have the final hearing, and he's going one way or another, and they're pretty radical extremes. He is either going to be found guilty and executed, or he's going to be found innocent and set free. Okay, you think about it, those are pretty radical. It's not like, okay, you're going to get a 5-year in imprisonment, or you know, you're going to be beaten with rods, and then we'll let you go. It's complete freedom or death. And so really, as you look at chapter 1, he's kind of wrestling with which one he prefers as he contemplates wondering what is going to happen. And so as he is there, he is in this prison, he is facing either death or release. He can either go on with his work or his work is ended in this life. So that's the condition he's in. Meantime, let's talk about the conduct of the church at Philippi. The church at Philippi really loves and cares about Paul. So what they have done is they have gathered up a gift for him. Difficult would be the understatement of the century to describe life in a Roman dungeon. It was cold and miserable. And many of the prisoners, their hope of survival depended on contact from the outside. If they wanted to have covering in the cold weather, somebody from the outside had to bring it. If they wanted to have something decent to eat, somebody from the outside had to bring it. And it was tough for prisoners who didn't have outside contacts. And so it seems that the church at Philippi sent a gift to Paul, maybe money and food, whatever, by the hands of a man named Epaphroditus. But what happened is when Epaphroditus got there to deliver the gift, we talk about this at the end of chapter 2, Epaphroditus gets sick. He gets so sick that he almost dies. The church back at Philippi hears about this. So they're already worried about Paul and what's going to happen to him. They send a man to help out. He gets sick. He may die. So, I mean, they're on the verge of not only losing Epaphroditus, but on losing Paul as well. Epaphroditus, in the meantime, finds out that everybody at Philippi hears he's sick. And so you've got Epaphroditus likely feeling bad because he's got everybody at home worried. He may feel guilty because he's supposed to be here to help Paul. He's not only supposed to deliver the gift, he's supposed to stay close by and minister to Paul's needs. Well, now he's sick and somebody's having to minister to him. So the church back at Philippi is worried about these people. The church is also maybe feeling down and discouraged because they wanted to try to help out. Now their messenger who was going to help out is sick himself. Epaphroditus feels bad, literally feels bad to the point of dying. But he may also have felt guilty because he's not able to help Paul. And so you've just got a tough, tough situation. And Paul's heard a little bit about the church at Philippi and how they're doing from Epaphroditus. And so you've got these conditions where Paul's in prison, the church is worried about him, they're worried about Epaphroditus. And what happens is Epaphroditus has gotten better. He's gotten well enough that he can go back home. And so what Paul decides to do is he is going to send a letter back to the church at Philippi by Epaphroditus. And so I think therein lies basically the reason for the correspondence between Paul and these brethren. If you look at the letter, he doesn't seem to be addressing any major problem. That's different from a lot of the other letters. That's different from what we saw in Galatians. That's different from what we saw, for example, in 1 and 2 Corinthians. The tone in Philippians is much more positive, much more upbeat, much more personal than especially, say, for example, a letter like the book of Galatians. So he's not writing dealing with major problems, though there were some things that he talks about at the beginning and end of chapter 3. That's not really why he's writing. This is an encouragement letter. Every once in a while, I've gotten some wonderful letters from people over the years. I got one, I think it was this last week, that's one of the most positive and encouraging letters I've ever gotten in my life. Maybe you've gotten one, and you can think about times in your life when you got just the right note, just the right word, just the right visit or phone call from somebody that gave you the courage and the strength to go on. That's what this letter is. It is a letter that is being carried by a man that has been sick and almost died, that may feel guilty because he got sick and couldn't help out Paul. It's going to a congregation that's worried about Paul, has been worried about Epaphroditus, don't know what the future holds, and they just want to do their part. And so he is writing from prison, trying to pick everybody up. He's trying to encourage them and give them hope. And so in this letter he's saying, receive Epaphroditus warmly. And hey, by the way, I'm sending Timothy soon, and I hope to follow him. So make preparations for that. And so he's telling them about what's going on in his life. He's telling them to hold on, to hang in there, to be encouraging to the servants like Epaphroditus and Timothy who would come back to the congregation or come to work with the congregation. So if you have asked me to lay out what's going on in Philippians, the letter is a letter, it's a pick-me-up letter. And it's really, in my opinion, it's a letter that's all about attitude. The first chapter is really about Paul's attitude, in which Paul focuses on his attitude towards the Philippians. He expresses his love for them, his thanksgiving for them, his prayers for them, but also his attitude toward his current conditions. He's even got people who are taking advantage of his imprisonment to run him down. That there were guys out there preaching the gospel saying, basically, you should listen to me, don't listen to Paul, because he's in prison, obviously, because God's upset with him. And Paul says, I don't care what those guys are doing. What I care about is that the gospel is being preached. That's all that matters to me. All that matters is the gospel. And he basically says, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. If I live, great, because I get to promote and spread the gospel and help your faith, he says to the Philippians. He says, if I die, that's okay. I get to go to glory and be with the Lord. I'm okay. And so he sets the tone for the whole letter. My attitude towards you is that I love you. My attitude towards my condition is that no matter what happens, God will be glorified, and that's what my life is all about. And then he moves from describing his attitude in chapter 1 to in chapter 2 describing the attitude of Christ. And he calls on them to have the attitude in themselves which was also in Christ Jesus. And he describes this attitude of humility, this attitude of suffering. Now, why is that important? Because all these people are suffering. Paul's suffering. Epaphroditus is suffering. Philippi is suffering. They're worried. And he says, hey, our Savior went through the same thing. And he humbly and submissively and obediently submitted to this. And it says, therefore, as a result of that, God has exalted him and given him a name above every name, so that someday every knee would bow before him, every tongue would confess him. The message to the Philippians is, you just be like Jesus and it'll all work out okay. And then he gives some examples of people who have the same attitude. He talks about Timothy and he says, I don't have anybody that I know of who is as concerned about you as he is. I don't know of anybody that has the kind of attitude he does. And he talks about the attitude of Epaphroditus and how that he risked his life to take the gift from the church in Philippi. Those are living examples of people who have the attitude of Christ. In chapter 3, he deals with some wrong attitudes. He deals with some false teachers and their wrong attitudes. He then talks about his own wrong attitude in the past, how he was a persecutor of Christians. But then he talks about the transformation that took place in himself. He had a new attitude. And he says, I could brag on all the things I've done in the past, but he said, my attitude has changed. And he says, basically now my life is all about Jesus. And he says, I count all these but dung on the dung heap, but trash on the trash pile, compared to knowing Christ and to be able to accept the prize of His calling and to know the resurrection that He offers to His people. He's got a new attitude. He finishes the chapter talking about those who have a selfish attitude of wanting to work against Christ. And he says, even as I talk about these people whose attitude is against Christ, it brings me to tears. And then chapter 4, he talks about an attitude adjustment. He talks about how our sorrow can be turned to joy. How Paul has just said he's been transformed. And so he says to the Philippian brethren, as you're going through struggles, here's how you can be transformed. He says, you trust in the power of prayer. You focus on positive things. You treasure and value people. You have a proper attitude towards possessions. And you realize that the true power of life lies in Jesus Christ. Paul says, I don't need stuff. I can be content with having what I need. I can be content with going without. I can do all things through Christ. He is the power. As long as I have Jesus, I'm content and I don't need anything else. And then he concludes the book talking about the path to blessing. He says, I thank God that you gave the gift you gave to me, not because I needed it, because I just told you I don't have to have stuff. I'm content with going without, but because it will be credited to your account. You'll be blessed. And he reminded them that God supplies all our blessings. And so he says, live your life with the humble attitude of Christ. Live your life serving others. And no matter what happens in life, you will have joy and you will have peace. Forms of the word joy are found 16 times in this book. And the names for Christ and titles for Christ are found 51 times in the 104 verses. He says the key to joy is not whether you're in a dungeon or not. The key to joy is whether we're in Christ. Would you take out your psalm books and turn to the hymn of encouragement? As you turn there, I would like you to think about this quote from C.S. Lewis. He says, our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition. When infinite joy is offered to us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum because we cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at sea, we are far too easily pleased. He said, we're like that little boy, and somebody says, would you like to go to the beach? But he's never contemplated a beach before. He's never seen a beach before. And so he says, no, I'll just stay here in the slums and make my mud pie. C.S. Lewis says that's how we live the Christian life. God has offered us joy. He has offered us a happiness that transcends everything in life. But instead of saying, thank you, Lord, for this joy, I'll live every day as a transformed person. I will find happiness even in the sorrows of life. We say, well, Lord, thanks, but I don't really understand that. So I'll just keep making my spiritual mud pies and I'll live just an existence instead of a celebration. The Philippian letter, in my opinion, is God's cure for depression. And I can't tell you the times folks have come into my office discouraged. And one of the things I think if they were to tell you, one of the things I try to always mention is go home and read the book of Philippians. Because as you listen to the discussions from the dungeon, I think it can transform the way we look at life. Think about that picture. What did you see? Now think about our lives. What do we see? So we sing this invitation song. I hope you'll not see something to be afraid of. I hope you'll not see something that is routine. But instead, I hope you'll see a Lord who loves us and wants us to come to Him. Whether it's coming for the first time by expressing our faith in baptism and putting on Him, or whether it's coming back home to Him, seeking His warm hugs and His forgiveness. That He wants us to come, that He loves us, and this is not something to be afraid of. It's an opportunity to be loved by a friend. Won't you come as we stand and sing?